It is Saturday, April 12th, 2008, 10 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today, geek news and your calls and questions about technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or its board, the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation. Today, we are covering the week in geek news, and during the second half of the show, I will welcome you to join our conversation. The phone number, where you can ask us anything you'd like about technology, 476-2800. The other phone number, which is toll-free, 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can participate at our website, geekspeak.org. Go ahead and use the forums if you want an in-depth discussion. Or if you just want to ask us a question, you can send us email from there. And I'll give out all that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Geek Miles Elam.
Welcome, good Miles. Morning.
And we have Ben Jaffe. He's a geek and, oh, graduate.
Graduate.
Congratulations.
As of 3.5 weeks ago.
Yes, yes. We did that on air, actually. I was just listening to the other day. What are you doing now?
I don't know. Going on Geek Speak. And
well, I need a new title for you because you're not a geek student anymore. And also, it's redundant. All geeks are students. We all learn.
We're friends.
Well,
he can
right?
take over the role of Slacker.
Ooh, Slacker. Cool.
Oh,
Slacker.
No.
And
no,
Geek Slacker, Ben Jaffe. Welcome, Ben. And Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. You have an official title.
Yeah, I'm gainfully employed.
Yes. Yes. By a large corporation. How is it going there?
Oh, it's going great.
Good.
I'm enjoying it.
I'm glad to hear it. Well, we're going to take calls in the second half. But let's start with some headlines first, just a real quickies. Miles, NASA.
Yes, NASA has launched a new science education site at nasascience.nasa.gov, and it covers such things as planetary science, like climate change, carbon and ecosystems, atmosphere, weather, heliophysics, talking about stars and the magnetosphere on the sun, for example, the planets of the inner solar system, the outer solar system. Other things like the Oort cloud.
Nice. A reliable source for general science knowledge.
And astrophysics, which is an area where I think I'm spending the most time on the site, talking about black holes, galaxies, dark energy and dark matter.
Are you into astrophysics?
I don't know about how into it I am, but it's interesting. It's fun to learn about. And I think that's what NASA was making the site about, was for people who, they're not necessarily scientists, but it's still interesting and useful to read about this, to know more about our universe.
Well, great. Thank you very much. And we actually have news
and the URL. Yeah, and the URL is up on our site.
Yeah, nasascience.nasa.gov. But up at geekspeak.org, all the stuff that we're talking about today is up there, and it's going live as we speak. It's very exciting today. So, Ryder, what's going on with the shuttle?
Well, we were talking last week about the EEE, the ASUS PC, and it kind of got me thinking, you know, what's out there with low-cost PCs these days that are, you know, and this one came across Shuttle's new KPC. It's basically a low-cost, you know, Linux system. It comes either $99 bare bones or $200 for a complete system, I think excluding a monitor, but, you know, kind of flushed out with CD. It's small, you know. It's kind of like what's the small format that they call those little
toaster?
Boxes? It's toaster. It's smaller than a bread box, and it's great. They're kind of they're calling it the corporate with a K, personal computer, but it's really cheap. You know, it's kind of out there with in line with the Walmart Linux PCs. It comes with the Foresight Linux installed, which is okay. But they've installed XP on it and installs just fine.
It's fine. They're just not including XP because it costs more.
Now, if anybody's familiar with Shuttle, they're basically like these, you know, 6x7x11.5-inch boxes.
So really the size of it, like a traditional two bread toaster. That's pretty much the size of it. And we actually have some reviews of older Shuttle systems. It's kind of a common geek box.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's not like an e-machine where it's really hard to upgrade, but the power supplies in them are proprietary. The wiring is very tight. Miles, I think, fried one once by letting his friend Lyle work on the electrical.
No. It was fried beforehand. No extra damage.
You're not blaming me at all?
No, not at all.
I always feel like there's going to be blame about that little cube.
No. I brought a broken machine to you. It could not get any more broken.
Woohoo! This is a great little box for if you want to set someone up with an internet connection and they don't want a gaming system. It's really only got like an integrated Intel GMA 950 chipset in it, so it's not a
big
gaming
system.
It will run Vista with the Arrow, but it maxes out at two gigs of RAM.
Yeah.
It's got a Celeron processor.
So that's the new Shuttle. It's $99. Yeah. You can probably get it everywhere, I'm assuming, and it's called the Corporate Perfect Cube with a K.
For KPC.
KPC, okay. Thank you very much for that. So if you want to get someone that doesn't have a computer, there you go. Nice and cheap. And is it being stocked, or do you really have to go through?
You know, I went to the Shuttle's main site, didn't see it yet, but it's out there.
It's out there,
yeah.
All right. And links, of course, on geekspeak.org. Ben?
I have some kind of sad news, or at least it makes me personally sad. The College Board is canceling the AP Computer Science AB test. And don't misunderstand, they have two computer science tests, one of which I took, the A test, and then the AB test covers more data abstraction and a whole bunch of other stuff that's just like too much for 1 year, so, or too much for the A test. Well, anyway, they're canceling it because there's not enough demand. Uh-huh. And I guess I shouldn't be too sad because I didn't actually take it.
Were you a real good high school student?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I got a 5 on the test.
What happened to you?
What happened to me? Well, I went to college.
Now you're a slacker.
I went to college, and then I started working with you.
That's what did it.
Yeah.
So this basically means, I mean, it's kind of sad because it means that since there's not enough, I'm assuming that CS departments are still impacted and still have a lot of students going to computer science. It really has
not
to
as
do,
much.
Not as much.
Not,
okay,
not
I,
as many.
I was assuming that the load was not, it's not desirable because the high school
Or rather, the number of university students who choose computer science as a major has decreased.
It has decreased. Okay.
Has decreased.
That's interesting.
And so, as a result, you know, offering two tests and it doesn't make much sense because they have so few people enrolling in AB, and also a lot of high schools do not offer AB. They only offer A just because
it's a lot of load. And,
yeah,
and it's one of those things where unless you have a giant student body that can fill that class, you do better to teach other classes.
Yeah.
That's kind of a shame. Speaking of CS degrees, the UCSC where I'm working has a gaming track they started this year, a degree in gaming and in computer science. And I went by, we did an open house over there, and saw like one of their hangout rooms. I want to go back to college and go be in the gaming track. It just looks really cool.
Yeah, I'm kind of bitter that they introduced that my second year.
Yeah, because you wouldn't have gotten your theater degree. Okay, moving on.
Maybe not.
Miles, what's going on with the politics in YouTube?
Lawmakers are getting their very own sites for videos, according to the Washington Post. There is a rule, or a prohibition, I should say, against members of Congress to redirect their users to for-profit sites, to commercial sites.
Right.
In terms of...
Because you're basically, effectively, you're using
your political
state money
to help a specific entity.
Right. Yes. It's actually the reason why we don't have any advertising... we won't get into that. Okay, any case, I don't know enough about it. So
YouTube is going to make a special section of their site, or maybe even a subdomain, that is going to be for members of Congress. That doesn't have any ads, it doesn't have any reference to YouTube itself. It's just a repository for those members of Congress to get their message out cheaply, and trying to lower the cost of entry so you're not beholden to large interests that have TV stations or, the horrible radio station. that you can put up whatever messages you want, as long as people are willing to listen to what you have to say or watch what you have to show, that they will be able to, that will not be, no longer be a barrier.
So does it have to be political? I mean, commercials are kind of annoying anyway, so why can't I just go there to watch all the YouTube content, or is it only specific content that's placed there?
There's nothing stopping a constituent from going to YouTube to see things that are made by on a commercial scale, something, things that are like TV ads for campaigns or recordings of speeches that people have made. But this is going to be an official arm of Congress to be able to put up this information without any restrictions.
Okay. So does that mean whenever you see that information, the ads will be removed from the page? Or are you or is it if you go to the those political pages and you link over to YouTube, you will not see advertising from that link?
It's a special section of YouTube. Okay. It's not part of the general site.
Okay. Gotcha. So there'll be a commercial-free, for commercial-free purposes section
exactly.
of YouTube.
Exactly.
The question I have is, will different content exist there? Could I start viewing all the YouTube content in the commercial-free area, or is the content actually being split between...
I don't know, because it's not done yet.
Yeah.
At the same time, I would imagine that a link to a YouTube site would mean you have to go to the main YouTube site.
Sure.
And so that content that is available for Congress would be linked off of the... candidate or the incumbent site.
If you're interested in politics, videos of such, of course YouTube, you can get a lot of stuff on there. You can also take a look at a project that I help on a little bit called MetaVid. And you can learn about it going to metavid.ucsc.edu. It's congressional and footage of our government doing their business, and it's kind of a cool place to
Available
check,
by keyword.
Available by text searching, that's right. All right. What are we on? Let's see. I guess we're going to...
Wow, smooth transition.
Yeah, I know. I'm editing the site at the same time, as you can see. Oh, yes. Ben, musicians, have
All
some
right.
help from Microsoft?
So let's say you're a singer, Lyle.
No, let's not.
Let's say you're a decent singer. You sing in the shower all the time.
All right, in this magical mystery
and
world.
Yeah. You've got all of these song ideas because you're just a prodigy, but... You know, because you never learned how to play musical instruments, you can't put it down on paper. And also, you don't have any musician friends or any friends at all. And
yeah.
No, maybe. Now
that
maybe,
you're getting
maybe.
Closer. You're getting closer, Ben.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, so you don't have any way of getting this down. And so there's this new technology that's being developed by Microsoft's research lab in conjunction with the University of Washington called MySong. And basically what this does is it gives you a click track and you sing into a microphone, and it does two things. One, it pitch tracks your the audio input you're giving it, so it figures out what notes you're singing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it uses a technique called chord probability computation to figure out what chords would accompany the melody that you gave it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll actually kind of arrange a very simple general MIDI output of chords. And so now you have chords going with your song. And you don't even have to think about it. Okay,
it's an automatically generated backup band.
Exactly. Except it's MIDI. So
you know, you always say it's MIDI. MIDI is just an interface to say this is the type of generic music. It's the rendering quality that you don't like.
Most computers render MIDI.
Yeah, most
by definition is.
General MIDI you can take and feed it through a better synthesizer and create good music.
There's nothing
behind the Gravis Ultrasound Max.
Miles knows.
There's nothing worse.
Cable on it.
There's nothing worse than General MIDI staccato trumpets. That is.
You mean the ones, the most
horrible thing. That's in my nightmares.
but you're talking about the MIDI synthesizer found on.
Yeah,
for
General
example,
MIDI.
Found on, for example, the original Sound Blaster, the Sound Blaster
Pro.
I'm saying that they have improved tremendously since then.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying that MIDI is useless. I'm just saying the general MIDI is ugly sounding.
So in other words, you're arguing about how bad the technology was 10 years ago without acknowledging how it is today.
Yeah.
Well, no, but every computer can do general MIDI.
Okay, but here's an example of my laptop doing a MIDI track real quick. So see if we can get
to
it.
Yes.
I mean, well, we'll do it in a second. I'll play it in a second because it's loading up. But actually, I'm going to a site called supercomposer.com, which is a company that's recumbent. Well, in any case, go to supercomposer.com if you want to create a unique song for yourself. I'm going to start and play it. It's going to take a second. This is generating the composition as we talk right now, a brand new song. And they do some really cool technology. But in any case, this is what MIDI sounds like.
I could listen to that all day.
See? So. See, Ben, it's beautiful. I'll fade that out. Oh, that's the trumpets? It's delicious. Okay, I'm going to fade that out, too. Mic down. All right. Enough MIDI playing.
Anyway, the really neat thing about this is... So there's no right way to accompany a given melody.
Yeah.
There are tons and tons of ways you could possibly accompany it, right? Different chords and everything. And so they give you these options. They give you these two sliders. One is the happy factor. So you can slide it at the far left. You'll get a bunch of minor, sad, depressing sounding chords, and you'll hate your life. And if you bring it to the right, you'll have a nice major, you know, hip. I don't know.
Yeah, I love it. You're saying that music, yeah, the different attributes of music, two sliders, you can cover everything.
Yeah, and the second one is the jazz factor.
Oh, jeez.
So,
what does the jazz factor do?
Makes it more jazzy. I imagine it makes it more jazzy.
This is okay. It's cool. You know, you're getting people that don't have a bat, you know, yeah, have friends to play an instrument, play an instrument. But at the same time, the idea of generalizing what music creation is down to a couple sliders.
Well, but I mean, you can't create the same quality of music. You can't, you know, make something on my song necessarily
and bring art.
Bring it to a record producer and say, here, I want you to play exactly what the computer just played.
Okay, but...
Because it'll sound horrible.
But actually, Ben, you can do that kind of thing. In fact, we've had on our show a couple times a person that can do artificial music, the expert in artificial music, who's actually at UCSD.
David Cope. Yeah.
And David Cope can generate... With Emmy, his music system, he can generate absolutely new songs. In fact, that MIDI file I just played from Supercomposer is David Cope's engine behind it.
Yes, that is
but
different.
Contemporary
and
music,
he does some incredible things. Definitely, I've looked at a lot of his stuff too. It's really, really neat. And I actually took a class with him too. But I mean, like with my song, you're not just gonna sing into the computer and have it write a song for you. Be put on a record.
But in any case, it's pretty cool.
Yes, yeah, right. It is very cool. And one really quick other thing is if you go onto the URL, which is up on GeekSpeak.
Okay, wait, is it?
Yes, it is.
Because I can't find that entry.
It's not? What?
Well, what
yes,
is it?
It is.
What is it, MIT?
Oh, no, it's not. It'll be up there very shortly.
Ben.
Oh, I'm sorry. But
you can
what
play
they do
it?
Is they take it one step further and they use the software called Band in a Box, which will take a chord progression and you can tell it what style you want to play it in, and it'll actually arrange it, and you know, it'll make MIDI sound good, pretty good, you know. So I don't know, I mean, definitely my song on its own is just something to get down ideas.
All right.
Instant cool.
Band backup, Microsoft technology, my song. Ben's gonna have it up on geekspeak.org. and now we go to what MIT is doing, Ryder.
Well, MIT's come up with a new way of determining the speed of hurricanes.
The wind speed or the
wind speed.
Travel speed?
The wind speed.
The wind speed of hurricanes. Okay.
So basically categorizing it. That's the main way they categorize it. And currently what they do is they have these $100 million planes that basically fly over the hurricane and do, you know, speed measurements, you know.
Doppler effect, probably speed measurements, like that.
Something like that. You probably know. I don't know.
I thought they did it like terrestrial. They just put up
sensors. $100 million planes, they got to be really beefy so they don't basically, you know, get sucked into the hurricane. And they estimate individual flights cost around $50,000. So it's an expensive prospect to do something as simple as determining the speed of a hurricane. So new research from MIT has found out a way of basically placing underwater microphones in the water ahead of the path of the hurricane. And based on the sound of the oceanic storms as the hurricane's traveling through, they can determine the approximate speed of the hurricane. There's a direct correlation between the sound of the ocean storms.
So now
and
the planes basically drop cheap microphones in front of it, not having to go into the hurricane.
Yeah, or
and
boats.
Then when the hurricane passes over,
thinking they can also, you know, actually additionally, you know, add extra sensors on these microphones, keep them stationary, and do saltwater measurement content for, like, you know, global warming predictions, and, you know, the multi-purposing.
Getting a better idea of what the climate changes are.
You know,
that's cool.
Actually, pretty simple, but, you know, kind of a nice, cheap alternative.
What about
those
daredevils that are in the planes? I mean, what are they going to do?
Well, they'll just go on to, you know, helicopter tours or something.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Thank you for that. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. That was Ryder Brooks. We also have Ben Jaffe. And this is Miles Elam talking about domain names.
Network Solutions, the company we love to
hate.
Bash. Yeah.
The largest domain name
registrar out there.
Out there, yeah.
They, in the past, have done what's called domain parking or hijacking, where if there's a domain out there but it doesn't have a website associated with it, they would provide one that was full of ads so they could generate revenue for Network Solutions. Mm-hmm. Now they're going one step further and adding subdomains to the ad fest. In other words, a subdomain is...
Let's use geekspeak.org for example.
Right. Geekspeak.org is our domain name. A subdomain would be, www.geekspeak.org or forums.geekspeak.org. So a site or name underneath the main domain name. There's basically an unlimited number of these, for all intents and purposes, an unlimited number.
So, for example, let's say we were doing something we wouldn't do, taking geekspeak.org and registering it at Network Solutions. We don't. We actually use gkg.net. In any case, though, if we were registering with them and they were handling the DNS entries, if anyone asked for Superforums, which we don't have the domain for, Superforms.
Or misspelled it,
like forums, geekspeak.org.
Or www.geekspeak.org.
Or www.forums.geekspeak.org, which would be a common one.
No, I'm thinking like they were put in www. If we didn't put specifically www as a typo, a common typo, or someone puts in four W's.
So common typo, if we weren't actually entering and making an entry for it and then having it direct to our site, they instead would do an advertising?
They have that option, yes.
That's not cool. Is that inside their like user agreement, or are they actually doing
it
now?
Yes, it's in their user agreement.
Oh, man.
Buried in their something like a 29-page.
You know, transferring away from Network Solutions is a nightmare, too. If you've made a change to anything in your Network Solutions, or in your register information, for 40 days is a freeze. You can't transfer it. That means if you go up and go, oh, I want to transfer it. Oh, my name's spelled wrong. You fix that, and it's locked down for 40 days. In any case, you use what do you use for your domain name? We're making suggestions to get away from Network Solutions if you know what we're talking about. Don't go with Network Solutions as your domain registrar. We use for GeekSpeak and a couple of domains, I use GKG. There's also...
I use Joker.com.
Joker.com.
It's a European registrar.
Ryder?
Do
you have a registrar?
Yeah.
What domains do you have?
I don't know what the name of it is.
That's okay.
Yeah. It's... the cheapest one I can find. Yeah.
And the cheapest one you can find is what's the one that has all the commercials?
Oh, something Daddy.
GoDaddy.
I mean, that's what I'm using.
And I don't like GoDaddy because the interface is so bloated, and I think spending a little bit more money is okay.
No,
and
they have their own problems too.
Yeah, I don't know if they're
similar problems.
Okay. Don't know if they're still doing this, but Network Solutions would also send mail when your domain was coming up to be to expire that you needed to re-register. They would send mail to you saying, hey, your domain's about to expire. You should register with us.
You're right.
And it was this domain poaching. I don't know if they still do that.
Other companies do it. I get messages all the time.
If you get a letter in the mail from your registrar saying, hey, or not from your registrar, if you get a letter in the mail saying your domain's about to expire, register with us and keep it for, throw it in the trash.
It's spam. It's physical spam. Well, thank
because you're going to pay for that domain name, and chances are you still had a year left on your domain.
That's right.
You're not going to get that money back.
Normally they add the whatever domain time you have to the transfer.
No, they don't.
Oh, they used to do that. Evil, evil. Okay, GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The numbers are 476-2800. That is 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Did you hear something in the news that you want to know more information about? You want to ask us about something about your home? I don't know, about your computer, maybe. Maybe your computer. Or your refrigerator. Or how stars work. You know, give us a call. We'll... the latter one we won't answer correctly. Everything else we'll answer correctly. Of course, stay tuned with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Ryder Brooks. Please join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476 2800. Again, 476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. And as we wait for Rick to take the calls and pipe them into the air room, let's go ahead and go on to the next story, which, if I scroll correctly, I don't know what we're doing next. Ben, traffic lights.
Traffic lights. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure a lot of people have noticed this happening in a lot of cities around the U.S. Cities are being caught illegally tampering with the traffic lights, specifically the duration of the yellow light. And so numerous studies have shown that if you lengthen the duration of the yellow light, you know, it goes green, yellow, and if you lengthen that time, then you have way, way fewer accidents. Because people get used to it and people don't slam on the brakes and you don't have the rear collisions and everything. But people or cities have been decreasing this duration, in fact, below the legal limit to increase revenue for red light cameras. So that's no good.
How do you know? Is there a way to detect that? I mean, is it based on the speed of the traffic on the road and the duration of the light? Could I go up and test it? Do you know the stats?
Well, I do know. This is all like 4-year-old information in my brain, but I did know that on roads with speed limits of like 50 miles an hour, they have to have a much longer yellow light than on, you know, a 25-mile-an-hour road, for example. But I don't know, like if definitely this has happened to me a lot where you get really accustomed to how long a particular light is, especially if you commute by it every single day.
Sure.
And if it changes, you notice, you know, yeah. Because either you accidentally run the red light or you see someone else do it or, it just feels wrong. It's
okay. And I agree. And I think it's kind of interesting that people are tampering. It is definitely a technology thing. But the geekiest way for us to deal with this right now.
Yes.
To find out what the duration versus posted speed limit is and actually be able to go time yellow lights and know if our city is that we live in, whatever one it is being illegal. So if you could do a little research on that, Ben, right now, that would be totally cool. But if not, I totally understand.
I know that there's 6 cities that are being called out.
Which ones are they?
Dallas is one of them. I need to find the others, though.
All right.
Somewhere in this article. Oh, God. My computer's still playing MIDI trumpets.
Well, while we're waiting for you to do that and everything.
And I would imagine where we used to work down in Southern California near Burbank, I would imagine they're one of the culprits as well. I noticed that when we were working down there 7, 8 years ago.
The thing I most remember about Burbank was that you would definitely get a jaywalking ticket if you crossed even a small road and there was a cop around.
Or in the downtown area, yeah.
Yeah, they liked giving tickets for traffic.
Union City, California, Dallas and Lubbock, Texas, Nashville and Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Springfield, whatever MO is, Montana?
Missouri.
Missouri? Mm-hmm. I never
remember. What's the capital of Missouri, Miles?
Oh, my.
There. You know what MO
St.
is,
Louis?
Miles? Sure, I'll go with that. All right. I don't know who is on the phone, so Miles, who's on line one? I'm having Meebo trouble.
Line one is L from Ben Lomond.
Well, hello, L. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, my name is Aya.
Oh, I'm sorry, Aya.
No problem. Love your show. Listen every Saturday religiously. And I had a question about, at some point in the future, I wanted to buy a Mac laptop, but I wanted to know the difference between that and just an ordinary Mac, because my teacher told me that the Macs tend to heat up. Is that true?
All computers heat up. There's definitely energy waste on computers. Right now, we were just talking about this earlier today. We all actually have the same model of laptop right now. They're all Macintoshes, mm-hmm. MacBook Pros. I have the slightly older one. But so we're all using them, and you guys feel your computers? Warm.
Mine gets hot, but it's not like scorching hot.
You can comfortably have it on your lap.
Yeah.
I don't mind it being hot. I just don't want it to affect, you know, anything that's technical.
Well, no, they've designed laptops, so they're not going to fry themselves.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The biggest thing with a laptop is it's very common to use it like with bedding or a sweater or something like that. Uh-huh. If you put your laptop down on top of something that's very insulated like that and has fluffy parts, the fluffy parts will block the vents, right. And the machine will get warmer and warmer, and it will slow down because of that. And can even shut down if it gets hot enough. But really the best way to deal with that, if you're like using your laptop in your bed, for example, get us something flat and hard that's at least as big as the laptop and put it under that, and then it will take care of that problem. So you're not going to have a problem with heat from the designs. The laptops are going to get hot, and they are designed to do so.
Do you think that is the choice that I should make? I do a lot of photography, and I have a lot of photographs. Would a laptop do, or should I get the standard Mac?
Do you want to be portable? Do you want to be able to go to your coffee shop?
Well, I live in a really small studio, and so I like small things that don't take up a lot of room. And meanwhile, I have something else that takes almost half up the, with the monitor and everything else.
Are you using a Macintosh right now?
Yes, I am.
What are you using, like a G4 tower?
Actually, I've written to you about it before. Oh. It's something that I bought from somebody who remodeled it, but I took it down the Dave's, as you people recommended, and it turned out that they had never seen a motherboard so screwed up, so I got screwed. So
at some
point, and it keeps on crashing every other minute, and so at some point I have to start saving up money, but I figured I'd call you now when there was a gap where we could call. And
well, yeah, I think a laptop's a good choice. I'm a photographer. I have a collection of 40,000 photographs right now. And I, plugging in two external hard drives, can look at all of my library at once on my MacBook Pro. So not all 40,000 photographs. My eyes can't actually take all that information in. But I guess if I made them all like one pixel, I could do it. In any case, though, if I can scroll through it, I can find things. I can look up, pictures of people that I know. And the application I use is called Lightroom. It's from Adobe. Uh-huh. I highly recommend it. I know another photographer friend of mine who knows a lot about printing. He really likes the conversion tools that are Macintosh, Apple's Lightroom
Aperture.
Equivalent, Aperture. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah.
And that's another good library management. The biggest thing, of course, with photo management is making sure you have backups, because your drives, all drives crash, and I hope you have a good backup solution.
Speaking of which, what CDs, because one time I called, you said I could back it up by...
DVDs.
I wanted to get CDs. That's the easiest and the cheapest for me. So what CD would you recommend?
I would definitely get a brand name CD. That's what we really normally recommend, especially if you're dealing with archives.
Yes.
Because you're assured kind of a large corporate name behind it, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody have a recommendation on which types? It doesn't really matter. If you recognize the name, Sony's on there, TDK's on there.
Okay, cool.
And the other thing, though, is backing up to CD... DVDs are about the same cost as CDs, and they hold, times more?
4.3 gigabytes.
Yeah, but
how many? 700 megs.
So what's the calculation on that? Four times. No, six.
4.3 over 7.
Times, yeah.
Thank you, Ben.
0.7 over 0.7.
And so did the CD BR or that other thing, WR?
Blank CDs that you buy will be fine. Any blank CDs or any blank DVDs that you find.
WRs are rewritable.
With your new laptop. Oh, yeah, WRs you don't really need.
They're rewritable. I've had them. I've never actually rewritten a CD ever.
RWs.
Because they're so...
Yeah, so cheap.
We like and the to, same with the DVD.
Yeah, we've never really recommended rewritable discs.
Yeah. Okay,
they're
so
a little
the
more
R.
expensive. The R. Dash R
okay,
plus
the R.
R.
Dash R. Dash R. Okay, I'm just... Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And again, your name?
Aya.
Thank you so much for calling
in. Thank you. Bye.
From my hometown of Ben Lomond, actually. All right, and we are waiting for calls and questions of about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. We'll take any calls today. And the toll-free number, I believe works anywhere, is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. We are going to go to Atlanta, Georgia right now to a regular caller and listener. Larry, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Guys, thank you so much. Good morning. How are you?
Quite well. Larry, do you call with the 800 number?
Oh, yes, I did.
So the 800 number works in Georgia, which means it probably works in the continental U.S. Great. Larry, what's your question today?
Okay. Well, first, I'll say thank you for taking my call, and then I need to back a little bit and tell you what I am. It is essentially a one-person, home-based consulting business.
Sure.
And I think what I'm doing right now is as I'm working on a marketing plan, what I've done so far, it's created a database of about 7,000 email addresses of my closest friends, and every month I plan to send them a newsletter.
Okay.
And in addition, what I like to do is set up a web preference website. Now, what I've done is I registered my domain name with in fact GoDaddy.com, and what I need to ask you is the kind of protocol I need to use to have my website hosted.
Okay, so you're going to register GoDaddy. I would go ahead and buy GoDaddy's web hosting product, which costs, I don't know, about $40 a year, maybe it's a little bit more. They have a whole bunch of really easy to add in plugins. They also have mass email support for like news lists. So GoDaddy, if you've already registered with them, I just set up a web blog using GoDaddy. It was quite simple.
Okay,
So again, so I would suggest go ahead and use GoDaddy if you're there already. The transferring process would take a long time. And when you're in GoDaddy, go ahead and buy the tons of advertising products that they have. Make sure you kind of read through what they're actually offering, and then go ahead and buy that. If they have an 800 number, and you can actually sit down and talk with a sales rep, I'd go ahead and go to do that too, because to some degree, you have an idea of exactly what you want. There's going to be a lot of choices, and you're going to have to do quite a bit of research about what they're offering to see if those choices will work. But in any case, GoDaddy's a really good solution for out of the box products for your website and for emailing. Thank you so much for the call, Larry.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, let's go ahead and we'll go ahead and talk to another pretty regular caller, Judith from Watsonville. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah. I was calling. I wanted people to know about there's a FCC hearing on broadband network management practices.
Does this have to do with like?
It has to do with like keeping net neutrality.
Net neutrality stuff. Yeah, sure.
And it's it's open for the public to be able to testify. And I thought, you know, maybe some of you Schlacker geeks could go, you know, go and let. At the voice to call for net neutrality.
And where is the hearing? Is it a local?
It's at Stanford University. It's going to be on from 12 noon till 7 p.m. And
today?
And it's at Dinkelspiel Auditorium on the Stanford campus.
Is that today?
No, it's coming Thursday.
Okay, Thursday.
Thursday the 17th. And the address is 471 Lagunita Drive, Stanford, California.
And I do highly support this as well. The practices that I didn't know it was the FCC that was regulating this. So are you sure it's FCC regulation about
net
neutrality?
It's FCC hearing. FCC hearing on broadband networks.
If you want to participate on this and actually learn a lot more, you'd probably learn quite a bit going to this meeting and such. Visiting the Stanford campus is a fun thing to do if you're on the Central Coast. We'll put up that URL on our website in just a little bit. And thank you, Judith. Yes, it is a very important thing. Miles, you want to give us a little... Thank you, Judith, for the call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Miles, you want to just give us a quick rundown on net neutrality and what the issue is here?
Net neutrality refers to the ability of an ISP to regulate basically to charge twice for content. You as a consumer are purchasing your cable internet or your DSL or whatever, and so you are paying for access to the internet.
Sure.
Net neutrality would allow an ISP to say, well, web traffic, they already do track it or do traffic shaping to say web traffic may have a higher or lower priority than email. Usually email will have a higher priority. But it would also allow them to say, well, Google seems really popular. We're going to make up different tiers to say if you pay us a little bit more, if Google pays us a little bit more, then we'll make sure Google goes
faster.
The general
idea is that they will start – it's kind of like the cable idea where you pay for your television – well, it's a little hard to explain, but basically the idea would be the ISP right now has customers. Their customers, their only customers right now, are the people that are getting broadband from them. What this would now enable is for that ISP who controls a whole bunch of people's access to the internet to say, hey, Google, if you want really good access to your services from our customers, you have to pay us. So they would get a second customer, if you will. The ISP would actually start collecting money from people that are broadcasters or websites. The thing that's so ugly about this is it totally changes the dynamic online. Right now, if I put a website up and Google has a website up and you want to visit either of our websites, the traffic flow will be the same. There's no priority of traffic flow because it's both the same protocols. So the ISP is going to look at, you know, geekspeak.org and google.com as the same importance. And that means that everybody has the same level. So it's a kind of democracy issue in my mind.
Or egalitarian, yeah.
Yeah.
At the same time, this is not a website. If GeekSpeak came to someone's home and it took twice as long as, you know, Yahoo.com, not that big of a deal. However, if you're looking at video sites, it makes them able to say, well, Comedy Central, they didn't pay us. So when you view videos from Comedy Central's site, you get a lot of the video starts to sputter,
sure.
Starts to play and then pauses, you know, things like that.
What you're saying is because you could start implementing these kind of shaping based off of which site it is, the ISP would effectively kill sites that didn't pay them that have a lot of bandwidth.
It would make them seem like they are less reliable.
Yeah.
Even though from the back-end side, from the provider side, say Comedy Central or YouTube or whatever, that they are all the same. They have enough bandwidth.
Right.
They're just not getting through to the
And that's what's so ugly about it. Now, a lot of people say, well, what will happen, the market will correct itself. You know, if one ISP charges Google Holdbench and then YouTube does not, or YouTube and Cooler, I guess it's the same thing, but a different site that has video files, they're not paying the ISP and they start decreasing, the customers will complain and go, hey, ISP, you're not being fair, and therefore the ISPs will start, there'll be a leverage about selling their service. But the trick is that most of our ISP service is already kind of a monopoly. You know, you've got, if you can get DSL, people are using DSL. If you can get cable, you're using cable. You might have a choice there. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's always AT&T yeah. DSL, for
and
example.
That actually reminds me of the fiber optic service that's being rolled out across the country. With DSL, with the copper lines, the telephone copper lines, they were forced to open up to competition. That's why you're able to get providers like
Cruise.io
over an AT&T-owned line.
Right.
With fiber optics, that is not the case. And so you rip out the fiber optics and say, for example, Verizon installs that in some areas, not this one.
It's then, just like the cable line. It's owned
by
Verizon.
There is no competition.
Right.
It also means that those providers, especially the larger companies like Verizon or AT&T or Comcast, can make deals with content providers that have video to make their own content, make their own channels.
Yeah.
And basically kneecap the competition by making their product seem inferior.
Yep. So now your AT&T cable provider, they start having shows and content on their network. And if you try to look at YouTube and YouTube's not paying them, they decrease the quality on it, basically, or effective experience, and therefore killing that as a customer. So we geeks, 100%, and the geeks that support this show support net neutrality, absolutely. And
now, there is something to worry about with the term net neutrality. People talk about net neutrality and are on different sides of the argument. Net neutrality refers to everyone. It's neutral. Everyone is treated the same. But there are a lot of proposals out there saying, yes, we're going to be dealing with net neutrality, but they
it's not
mean
doing it's
not
meaning,
having neutrality.
It's meaning we're not going to regulate at all, and we're just going to let the ISPs do what they want.
Exactly.
So regulation is good. On the internet, everyone should be treated the same. Every site and every user should be treated the same. There should be no higher authorities, if you will. And that's the general internet is very much designed that way, and it's pretty cool. Let's keep it that way. All right, we're going to go to Boulder Creek. And, yeah, in Boulder Creek, John, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Quick question for you. I got an iPod Nano, and I put hundreds of CDs on the thing. And my thought is, well, when I lose this iPod, I'm going to be a little irritated. How do I back it up? My music library.
Your music library is on your laptop, right? Or your computer, too.
It's on my PC. Oh, so it's already there on my hard drive.
Yeah. Well, assuming that you took your iPod and you synced it with some kind of computer, and that's how you got all the content onto the iPod.
Right.
That scenario, that means the content was never actually moved. It was just copied. You have it on your original location. Now, there's another scenario. You get a used iPod from somebody, and it has music on it, and you want that music off of it. I won't get into the legal copyright issues because that's a quagmire, but let's say you want to get that content off the iPod onto a new computer. That you need to hack because iTunes doesn't support that feature.
Okay.
Ben got a link for that?
No.
I think Alex Lias, who is down south and is listening, as soon as he catches up to us, he'll probably go research that. We'll put up the grab content off any iPod tools, which are hacking tools, up on our geekspeak.org website.
So one quick question. So if I've used 4.7 gigabytes, I think is what it is, then a comparable level of storage has been used on my PC then, right?
Almost exactly the same amount.
Are you using iTunes to sync your music?
I have, yeah. I'm kind of a Luddite with this whole thing, but I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, it'll all be on your computer then, yeah.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, if you lost the iPod, get a new iPod and sync it up, and it's like you have the same old iPod.
Okay. And the playlist and all that, that's just so you can kind of cut and paste what or your preferences and then have it your own? Or
those are all controlled by iTunes on your PC. So as soon as you sync again, it's all right back.
And the reason for playlists in a lot of sense is that if you get, let's say, a lot more content onto your computer and you can't sync it all onto the onto your iPod because it's not large enough, you'll want to start managing playlists, that, and then you just sync the playlists, and that way you're kind of controlling how much content goes onto your iPod or which content goes on your iPod.
Okay, last esoteric nugget. Is the random truly random? I mean, the shuffle thing, is that truly random?
Truly random on computers is actually hard.
Okay.
So truly random, no, it is random. In all intents of human purposes, it is a random experience, yes.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so
much.
Love
the show.
Thanks. Bye.
Actually, some reporter was criticizing Apple and whatever and ran into Steve Jobs and was asking him about the iPod Shuffle and being random because he thought that his iPod Shuffle had preferences. And Steve Jobs apparently phoned up one of the lead developing engineers for iTunes and for the iPod Shuffle and wouldn't give him his name, but the engineer confirmed that, yes, technically it's as random as computers get.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is it's actually hard for a machine that does exactly what you tell it to do to create a random experience. There's tricks. There's computer science tricks, which AP classes could probably understand.
There are hardware tricks to do it, too.
Yeah.
You can't have a hardware.
There are hardware tricks that actually really will produce a random number if you assume that, like,
the flip a coin really, really fast.
No.
Well, no. I mean, according to basic – I mean, according – not basic physics, but it is – according to physics and Heisenberg uncertainty principle and the emanation of radiation off of a leaky capacitor, you will get a random number.
Yeah, yeah.
You will get random distribution.
Yeah, assuming that you think that the world works in the quantum state, which it does, you've got random qualities. Okay. From Santa Cruz, we're going to go to Albert. Welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, Albert hung up. Let's see. Well, Bob from La Salva Beach. Bob, welcome to GeekSpeak.
This is Bob.
Hi.
Hi. I have a MacBook Pro that's 2 years old, and it's 2 gigahertz Intel Core Duo processor with 2 gigabytes, 667 megahertz DDR2 SD RAM. And about 2 weeks ago, I installed Leopard version 5.2. And since then, I've had an interesting problem with my airport card in that in 2 weeks, maybe 7 or 8 times, it has dropped the network, and I go to the airport icon, and it shows that it's searching, and it'll do that forever and never find anything. So I have to completely shut down the computer and restart it in order to get everything to work, and it works just fine until the next time that airport card crashes. You had any experience with this?
Have you tried turning the airport card off and then on again?
It won't let you do that while it's searching. You can click on the turn airport off icon, and it stays locked in on searching for a network.
Really?
Yeah. So and it stays locked in that. I've gone away for 10 minutes and come back, and it's still locked in that.
When you tell it to turn the airport off, it stays on that? That's...
Yeah, and with the little thing on the right swirling telling me that that process is working.
Because I just turned my airport off and then realized I just severed my connection to the rest of the world.
It's just an inconvenience, but I wondered if any of you had that problem with Leopard or whether you've heard of that particular bug.
No, I haven't had that problem. It could be a hardware problem. That's one option. The solution at this point, are you still under Apple Care?
Yeah.
Go into an Apple store and tell them what's going on. They will fix that problem. You wouldn't believe. They'll probably crack it open, pull out the card, and give you a new card. But I would definitely do that. And you want to go to a store that actually has a tech crew there. If you're under Apple Care, it's amazing how much support you'll get.
It failed the first week I had it, and they sent me a Nancy box, and I sent it back, and they sent me a new computer.
And it's happening again.
Well, okay, no, I meant the whole computer failed.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, when it was brand new. And, of course, you know, most of those failures happen in very short order. And
sure.
It took care of it very quickly, and I was very pleased with it. But I can hand carry it in to a store with, you know, geniuses and all that, and they can probably take care of this.
Yeah, just because you've got the warranty, you might as well use it. And if it's a problem that happens often, they'll have the solution very quick.
Okay, it's only happened since I installed Leopard. It never happened in the 2 years.
Yeah, but what I mean is, have a lot of people with your model had the same experience on Leopard? If that's the case, they'll already know what the answer is. And that's the thing that's so nice about going to a place like that, if you've got the warranty. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, let's go ahead and cover another news story. I don't think we have time for a call, but no one's waiting right now. But let's go ahead and handle one more little story that I wanted to get to and just didn't really happen, and that is the Kraken botnet. Ryder, you want to tell us about that?
Kraken. Yeah. So there was an announcement that came out that there is a new botnet malware type virus called Kraken, and it sounds like it's actually a sort of a category of several types of botnets, but there's an article that came out saying that there's army of over 400,000 of these bots infected in some 50 of the Fortune 500 companies, and is reported to be undetectable in over 80% of machines running antivirus software.
Wow.
Which is pretty creepy.
Yeah, that is creepy. And can you give us a rundown real quick of what a botnet is?
Well,
a
botnet is a Trojan or virus that gets infected on a person's PC that basically turns it into kind of a zombie system, and it will be under the control of a remote person, and they can use it for sending out spam. What other stuff can it do?
Reason why we have so much spam.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, it's used in... And cybercrime, you know, mafia circles. Basically, it just creates this huge network of systems that can do its bot master's bidding.
And the size of these networks, what's the size of this Kraken one? It's the biggest
ever seen. They're estimating about 400,000 bots, but there's some debate over that from various analysts.
But let's assume the 400,000. I mean, it is hard to analyze because, of course, you don't really know and all that. But basically, when we talk about security holes and patch your computer and get an antivirus and get a... all these tools we're talking about, this, what happens to your machine if you don't do those things is your machine gets taken over by an application that runs on your computer, and it actually participates in one of these botnets, which means that somebody else then controls your computers.
Actually, an interesting note about the Kraken botnet is they're finding that 80% of antivirus software will not catch it.
Yeah, right.
And their further review is that that's reducing.
When giving that advice of saying, well, if you don't put antivirus on this, what's going to happen... It's happening anyway.
I'm saying, though, if you don't do these things, it definitely happens. Yeah. If you do these things, at least you're not a part of another work. The Kraken one, what's very interesting is that the code that's being developed is the actual... It self-modifies, so the signature of it gets changed. And the way we mostly detect viruses is we look at the bytecodes of the applications and see if patterns exist that match infections.
What I'd be very curious about is how many of these machines are XP and how many are Vista.
Yeah,
how
or 98 and such.
Well, I'm actually curious as to how Vista has withstood it. As opposed to
maybe more on that next week when Geek Speak comes back. Geek Speak's on every Saturday at 10 o'clock, and of course, podcasted through NPR at geekspeak.org.
So renew your virus definitions, everyone.
All the time. If you're on a Mac, don't worry about it until we tell you. Yet. Geek Speak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Broadcasting HD radio on 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH Santa Cruz, on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I am Lyle Troxell.
You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.